Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio, from creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences to audio secrets. Here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio, and I am actually peaking way more than I expected. Let me just do a quick check.
Welcome to the Game Audio Issue Hour.
Can we all just right. keep? I think we just keep that one in. I think that's a much better intro than we usually do.
Okay, yeah, let's do it. This is episode 230. I'm Vincent Diamante, and even though it is about just a little after noon here in California, I have been up for the last 9 hours, because that's what happens when you need to deliver on time. Let's see how well I do. I'm pretty sure that I have another hour left in me, so I don't make an absolute fool out of myself. I hope that everyone else there on this call is doing way better than me. Alex, you are at the end of your day over there in Sweden. Hopefully you've had a really great Friday. How's it been for you?
Yes, well, I've also been awake for the past 9 hours, but maybe under a little less stressful circumstances than you have been under, Vince. I'm normally, when you introduce me on the show, I make some pointless comment about the weather, but today I'm not going to do that, and I'm just going to say Roland Cloud. I'll just say Roland Cloud. That's been on my mind recently, and you can feel free to ask me about Roland Cloud later on if you wish, or I can just go straight into the weather, which is quite nice today. That's all from me. Back to you, Vince.
Roland Cloud. Roland Cloud. Okay. Thank you for the weather report. And now for more local issues. Mike, how are things going over there?
Things are going just fine. I've only been up for the last 7 hours, and that has nothing to do with my work ethic, but more about my quest to find when can you go to the gym and have it not be crowded. And the answer is not 5 a.m., as it turns out. So the quest goes on, but I am doing splendidly.
That is really awesome. I'm looking forward to hearing some more updates on that, because I need to go to the gym. My doctor has actually been bugging me about that lately. But who cares about that? There's way more pressing issues out there in the world of game audio. And actually, in order to further shed some light on this, we've enlisted a guest here. We actually have Brian Schmidt here on this call. And Brian is, well, let's just put it this way. He's a really awesome guy that has been doing this thing for far longer than the three of us combined, if you can believe that. But it is in fact true. Brian, how are you doing?
I suddenly feel really old, thanks to you. Thanks so much for that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. No, I wanted the emphasis to be on how cool you are and just how much experience you have.
I appreciate that. I get it. No problem. You are going to make me need to look up fortnightly to remember, figure out how long, often this podcast is, because it's not a word I use super often.
But we're in games, though. Everyone's fortnightly these days, it seems. It's either true. That or Genshin Impact. But
I do feel like a slacker, because I've only been up since 7. It seems like all of you have been like working, burning the candle at both ends. I hope you're taking care of yourself.
Around the clock, international schedules, you know.
All right.
We never sleep. There's always somebody on call, ready to answer the game audio emergencies around the world, or not.
Between the three of us, we've got the whole world covered. But honestly, it's great that you're taking care of yourself. Having a normal sleep schedule is pretty cool.
Yeah, actually, crazily. And that's something I know Chance Thomas is really big about. It's like, yeah, just taking care of yourself first makes you more productive. I definitely notice on days where I get a really good night's sleep that I just feel like I can like do anything the next day.
Yeah.
And if I don't get a good night's sleep, then it's like, oh man, how am I going to get stuff done today?
Yeah, absolutely. Totally, totally agreed. I think the issue of crunch and the issue of, I guess, let's take the gloves off and get straight to it. The issue of glamorization of the idea of crunch, especially in student circles, that, you know, okay, now I'm doing it. Now I'm a hardcore, real deal game developer. I'm legit now that I'm you know, doing the stuff at 3 a.m. in the morning. As you get older, I think you start to realize that really all of that is very, very self-defeating. And just as you said, Brian, you know, a good night's sleep, just you really do yourself a whole bunch of favors creatively and professionally and emotionally and physically and all those adverbs.
I get where it came from. Again, seeing how the game industry as a whole has evolved. When I used to work on like Sega Genesis games or something like that, or an arcade game, there was a date at which that game was done, right? And when it was done, it was really done. You're like, okay, this is the last build. This is what's going to get burned into ROM cartridges and manufactured. And there was no day zero updates or anything like that. And when we were doing those sorts of games, there was kind of, I hate to call it healthy crunch, but there was that last 4 or 5 weeks where you're working together and you're working late. And there's kind of this weird camaraderie you get from being up at midnight eating pizza and whatever together to get it done. But it was really time limited. It was just 4 or 5 weeks, and then it was done. And then the next 12 months of the year was pretty normal. And so I think what happened is that kind of culture where, okay, we're going to get that last little perfect bit of perfection in. We're going to add this one sound that I didn't think I had time to do or redo this animation. That when games grew in scope and started taking years with hundreds of people, all of a sudden that mindset of what used to be a really time-limited bit of bonding through working together for a common goal became this common thing that people did. And that's totally the antithesis of productivity. That's my little hypothesis where crunch came from. It's like this little bit of goodness you extend to be like nonstop for 9 months or 2 years.
There's an adage that schedules always expand to fill available time. And as you intimated, we now can deliver updates after shipping date. You know, you're not shipping a physical thing, a cartridge or a DVD that can't be easily amended. So the concept of the delivery has softened so much, and therefore the deadline, you know, it can expand infinitely, and crunch time can expand infinitely because there can always be patches and bug updates.
Yeah, the idea that you're done with the game, okay, RTM, okay, on Monday we start work on day zero patch. I don't see how that's sustainable. And I was talking with Richard Ludlow from Hexany, and you know, he has all of his people as employees. He doesn't really do a lot of contractors work. He'll hire composers and hire sound designers, and they have a pretty strict 8-hour day rule. In their contracts, they say our business hours are, I don't remember what it is exactly, like 8:30 to 6:30 Pacific time. And no, we won't answer emails on weekends. And he puts that in their contracts.
That's fantastic.
Oh, wow.
So that's hopefully that's that becomes a little bit more widespread. Boy, we just got into crunch right away. That's interesting. Yeah.
Maybe we could step back for a bit. You know, that whole idea of games being changed after release. I mean, I know that an NES cartridge might be a little difficult to deal with, or a Genesis cartridge, or you know, a PlayStation CD-ROM. But I am thinking about back in the day, there would be different iterations of arcade games that would come out. You would play something like Mortal Kombat, and there would actually be some very slight differences as the board gets remade and there's a new board revision. Maybe it's due to a changing bill of materials, or maybe they actually did some changes to the game itself. It's always really interesting to me to see that. If you are a hardcore retro enthusiast and you do a lot of game emulation, you might see on MAME that you can load up one of literally dozens of different permutations of the original Street Fighter II. We're not even talking about Street Fighter II Turbo or Super Street Fighter II. It's Street Fighter II, and then these different board revisions that correspond to different places around the world, as well as slight changes to the board itself and to the code. And I thought that was really interesting. And that just brings me back to you, Brian, because unlike us, you started pretty early on and we're dealing still with games that were primarily played in arcades, and not just video games, but also pinball machines. Those things would also have to go through that whole process of being manufactured, and you had to deal with things like, oh, what chips do we use, and can we actually make this according to this cost? And I just thought it might be interesting to hear what comes to mind when you think about the stuff that you dealt with when it came to shipping a game that was ultimately this physical artifact that was manufactured and shipped out to arcade operators.
Yeah, what a great question. Yeah, people sometimes forget that the video game industry actually started as a manufacturing industry. When I was working at Williams, which was my first job out of college, the Williams arcade game manufacturer, pinball and video games, literally the factory floor was right there, and we could see 300 workers with soldering irons and ratchet wrenches and things they used to literally physically wire up the play fields and so on. But yeah, we used to worry about how much things cost. I remember, you know, the first game I was working on, I was like, wait, you know, if we put in this just cheap little extra $5 sound, you know, ROM chip, we could have a lot more speech in the game. And wouldn't that be cool? And they're like, hey, you know, yeah, it looks great on paper, but let's take a look at that. That $5 chip times if we make, you know, I don't know, 40,000 pinball machines in a year, suddenly that's a fifth of $1 million you're costing us, Brian, just to have a little extra speech in the games. That was kind of an eye opener. People thought about it in that way. It was fun because we did have iterations and stuff that we would do. We'd typically take a prototype version of the game and drop it somewhere, you know, place it in either a bar or an arcade or something, and kind of surreptitiously watch people play to see, are they understanding the rules? Are they getting it? Are they having fun? You know, from my perspective, when they achieve a big thing, can you hear the sound across the arcade without it being annoying for people and so on? And then we would go back and we might make tweaks of the rules or tweaks of the sounds.
That sounds so cool. Like, I've got to admit that these days when I see those playtests, and even when it's things like remote playtesting done with these various companies that you can work with, and you just get a video, there's this anxiety and dread that fills me as I watch these guys play betas or, you know, very, very early builds of a game that I'm working on. And I'm like, no, this thing is horrible. Oh. And I wonder, was it a similar feeling for you back then?
I think the difference is that the games were almost done when we would put them on test. In other words, we wouldn't put the equivalent of an early access version of a game out into the field. But it's because it's cumbersome to update code and you literally have to drive the thing on a truck to go bring it to a place. Mm-hmm. You know, it was mostly done. We wanted to see where do we need to tweak it around the edges.
Okay,
that must be quite a complicated process, because if it's so late in the development, you know, if you find that, oh, actually look, all of these consumers are clearly not enjoying this game at all, it's sort of a little bit too late to make any, you know, sweeping changes. Did you have situations where it just seemed obvious that this game has seemed to have been heading in the wrong direction and now consumers don't appear to be enjoying it, but it's too late to go back, we just got to ship it anyway?
Yeah, what would typically happen in that case, and this is the game would just be canceled. There was game that it was not that long after Mortal Kombat came out, that I think if you Google worst arcade game of all time, it might come up, called Tattoo Assassins.
Oh, that game.
Yeah,
I remember reading about that game.
I did the sound on that, which I don't, let's just say it's one I don't put on my website.
Actually, I had obviously before the show, I had a look through your website and I was eager to see whether you were involved in a certain game by Williams, which has, in my opinion, probably the best sound ever in a video game, and that's Defender.
No, Defender is a little bit before my time. That was...
Okay.
So that game was developed by Eugene Jarvis and Larry DeMar. And Eugene did most of the sound programming, although I believe Sam Dicker did some of it as well. And okay. that's just pure sound friggin' wizardry.
I know.
Because there was no sound chip. All they had was what little bits of an 8-bit processor was left over from the rest of the video game and a DAC.
Yeah, and it's amazing. On a previous project, quite some time, it was actually a prototype. I did a real amazing few weeks of deep diving, trying to dissect actually how they did the sound for those early vector games like Tempest and obviously Defender as well, to try and get, you know, that very, very distinctive explosion sound in Defender when you die.
Yeah,
it's just so iconic and memorable. And I think in the end, I discovered that if you take a very, very short wavetable of noise and then just pitch the sample rate down, then you can make it sound like that. As the sample rate gets lower and lower, it sort of, the noise turns into these individual grains, which gives it that sort of sandy, grainy texture that you hear at the end of that sound effect in Defender, which is just so iconic. I'm waving my hands a lot here. You can't see that, but you know, I get that way when I talk about the sound in Defender.
Right. If it's interesting because the same sounds were actually available to us and the pinball machines, because it was, you know, same 6800 based microprocessor,
right,
with an 8-bit DAC. And one of the sound generation capabilities of the pinball systems when I first got to Williams was that old legacy Defender sound. And so, you know, if you were asking me this literally 35 years ago, I probably could have looked up the source code and said exactly what they were doing. If I recall, the memory was incredibly tight. I want to say Defender was like 8 kilobytes or something like that. So there's not even room for, you know, they didn't store specialized wavetables. But what they would do is do some crazy things like, let's pretend that computer code is sound data. And it's kind of random enough that it makes kind of noise-ish sounds, even though it's not random data. It literally is computer code that they would interpret as sound data.
That's amazing.
And then do various... This is the, again, I think I used the phrase friggin' genius of, Eugene Jarvis and Sam Dicker and getting so much out of virtually nothing.
Did those units suffer or benefit from the same idiosyncrasy that the ZX Spectrum had, where when it was playing a sound, that the whole frame had to freeze while it was playing a sound, which is on the ZX Spectrum games, that gives it that, you know, when it plays a sound, the basically the action will stop for an instant while the sound is playing, which gives it actually now when you look at it, it sort of seems like Vince, what is it called? We were talking about this before in like fighting games, when you land a punch in a fighting game, sometimes they have this.
Yeah, we were talking about hit stop.
Yeah, that's it, hit stop. Yeah. And when you look at those old ZX Spectrum games, they do that, but it's a technical limitation that causes it because it can only play a sound or do something graphical one and not both at the same time. But do you recall whether those whether Defender did the same? I don't think it did it?
I don't think so, because Defender does have a separate processor that does some of the audio stuff. So I'm pretty sure it just keeps going.
Yeah, amazing.
Thinking about game audio in those days, I keep remembering Berserk, which had voice synthesis.
Yeah.
I mean, primitive to be sure.
Yeah, that was back when LPC, linear predictive coding chips, were the big thing. They were, Texas Instruments had this, again, it's the Qbert chip was the same thing. It's like, how can we drastically reduce the amount of memory? Because, you know, there was virtually no memory in those things. And so Texas Instruments, for other reasons, had developed these speech synthesis chips. You know, you sent them it was almost like sending them MIDI commands, where it would be different phonemes, you know, and things like that, that you could tell the chip to make. And it would synthesize them, which is why, you know, it's got that kind of Stephen Hawking's vibe to it. So that's how speech in some of these games were done. In fact, Qbert was the iconic Qbert sound was Dave Thiel experimenting with, well, what would happen if I just threw random data at this speech synthesis chip, and that became the iconic Qbert swear sound.
That's amazing.
So yeah, it's a matter of what tech do you have? How do you see what it can do? And a lot of times they meant using it in ways that wasn't really intended.
For our listeners who might not be familiar with Qbert, get thee to YouTube and check it out, because the sound design was characterized by these vocal-ish utterances that sounded like they were in an alien language. And what Brian was alluding to is when you got hit in the head with an obstacle, Qbert would curse in a very sanitized way. You'd see a, you know, kind of a cartoon bubble with a number of punctuation marks randomly to denote bad words. And you'd hear just this string of gibberish, but it was weirdly expressive. And to think that they were able to do that back then is kind of astounding.
I'm really curious to ask about where the artistry of making sound for such limited hardware. You know, my first forays into game audio were on the Commodore Amiga. And by that stage, you know, you've got four channels of 8-bit sound, and there's quite a lot of, I guess, the ratio of, okay, I'm trying to overcome these technical limitations versus on the other side of the ratio, I'm trying to do something artistic and I'm trying to express something, was by that stage, you know, a little bit more comfortably providing you with the opportunity to be more artistically expressive. But on those early Williams hardware units and the pinball machines and the arcade units that you worked on, Brian, I imagine because the technical limitations were so strict on that ratio of, you know, overcoming limitations versus artistically expressing something, I imagine that there's quite a bit more of your time and energy goes into just trying to get this hardware to do something that sounds something like what you want it to sound like for the game. And the act of actually injecting in some kind of artistic intent or an emotional intent, expressing something through music or a sound effect, I imagine that must have been a bit more of a luxury. But could you speak to how it was in those days working with such incredible technical limitations, and where did you find those avenues to, I guess, express something musically?
Yeah, a really good question. The arcade, when I started, the arcade sort of technology of the time was FM synthesis. And the Williams the Williams pinball machines by then actually, I would say, had, you know, more flexibility than, say, the Commodore 64 or something like that. Mm. So we had 8 voices of 4 operator FM synthesis, which is it's the same technology that's in the Yamaha DX9 synthesizer, which is the baby brother to the famous DX7 synthesizer that was in probably, I think by law, it had to be in every song made in the 80s. It felt like there was some law that said every pop song has to have a DX7 in it.
Yeah, or a D50, right? The Roland D50. Yeah.
And so we had that available to us. We had an 8-bit DAC, and then we had the old-fashioned Defender system. So we, in the pinball days, and this was back in 87 when I started, we actually had those 3 different sound systems available to us. And with the 8-voice FM synthesis, you could actually do some pretty good stuff. Chris Graner did some amazing music. Again, it's the FM chip, if you take the time to program it properly, can do some good stuff. And when I first got to Williams, one of the things I ended up doing was writing some new editing tools that let us edit the sound of the Yamaha chip as it was playing in the game. So we could, you know, have a piece of music playing on the prototype system, and I could, you know, hit some keys on my 286 desktop PC with, you know, 1 megabyte of RAM. And it would vary the synthesis parameters of the Yamaha chip. So we kind of tweaked the, sort of edit the patches as it was playing. And so we used to get some pretty good stuff.
How did you program music? Was it on some kind of tracker system?
It was not a tracker. I've actually never used a tracker, but it was tracker-like. Most of the people at Williams at that time had kind of been educated through academic computer music study. If you were to go in 1985 and study computer music as an academic field, there were languages like Music 4, Music 5, C Sound. And it was just text files that were lists of notes, durations, volumes, parameter settings, pitches, rests. So we had these little arsenal of commands, and we would, you know, I would write my music out on manuscript paper just because that's how I compose. And then I would enter it in in a text editor. And then
it sounds a bit like Lilypond.
I'm not familiar with Lilypond. What's that?
Oh, that's the text-based open source scoring and notation. What is it? Help me out, Vince. Language?
Yeah.
I guess it's a language.
Yeah. If it's lists of, there'd be a track name, patch, base 1, volume 19, note E3, 30, which was an eighth note, E4, 15, which would be a 16th note. And think, mm-hmm. So we would just enter them like that. And it's these big, long lists. We do one for each track and then compile it into, merge it with the sound operating system and then download it to the chip emulator. Or in some cases, we actually would have to burn an EEPROM with that in it. So the turnaround time was horrendous. If you wanted to change the volume, when I first got to Williams, it was about 25 minutes to compile that note list into a binary image. And then it was another half hour to burn that image into an EEPROM that you would then take the old EEPROM out, put the new EEPROM in, and play the game. EEPROM is erasable programmable read-only memory. It's a computer chip that holds code, but you can erase it by sticking it under a UV light for 2 hours. So the turnaround time was a little longer than WISE.
A little bit. Just a little bit.
It sounds super important to have your music written out as, regular notation before you sit down to start punching it into the system, because unlike, at least with a tracker system, if you're used to working that way, you can visualize the music there, looking at, the columns of notes. You can sort of visualize it. However, in this case, it sounds almost impossible to visualize if you're just looking at, bass, E4, length, this, volume, this, and then the next note, length, this, volume, this. It sounds really, really important to have it written out on notation first.
Yeah, it definitely reduces errors. I did get to the point where I would start to get a little bit lazy and I would just compose directly in the text editor. Although wow. I found my music was better if I wrote it on music paper and transcribed it than if I tried to write it directly in the editor. I just think I wrote more stuff that way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was the way the system worked. And if we want, as far as getting back to your question about doing creative aesthetic things, the music coming off the FM chip, you can actually do quite a bit of stuff you can have very convincing. And I guess the trick is, well, it's like with any compositional challenge, right? If I'm writing for string quartet, I'm not going to try and make it do things that would be better suited to a brass section.
Right.
And so if I'm writing for Yamaha chip, I want to write within the capabilities of what that chip is going to sound pretty good at.
Mm.
And John Williams Orchestra is not something you try to do with a Yamaha chip.
Over the years, we've talked about the impact of tools on music composition style and how whatever composers are using at a given time tends to influence the choices and the musical textures and ultimately the style of music. So what you're describing is a little bit like film editing on a moviola, where every editorial decision takes time and involves a physical change and is hard to undo. So it's fascinating to think of how that would influence just stylistic choices in music.
And again, getting the turnaround time fast, right? Like I said, we did eventually create editors that let us cut down the time from having a note list to being able to hear it, from what literally was about an hour to about 5 minutes. So that was a big improvement. But even then, you sometimes are limited partly just by the number of iterations you can do on something where you don't have the ability to hear except in your head what's going to come out. I think one of the reasons that some of the iconic melodies in the 8-bit days, the NES days, is because when you're limited to those kinds of waveforms, well, melodic things work where emotional textures are not. And so Koji Kondo would write melodically because that's what the chip could pull off authentically. So you wouldn't let me instill a feeling of deep tension and fear simply by the timbre of the sound, because you don't have that kind of flexibility. Oh, but I can make nice rhythmic melodies that using the sort of Bach partita technique of, you know, alternating melody and bass with a single voice, make something that sounds pretty cool and compelling without using and staying within my, you know, 3 or 4 note resource that the NES used to have. So yeah, it definitely affects you a lot in the kind of things you can do.
It must have been the, do you remember when the, you know, on the advent of CD sound in video games, when it was possible to just basically have a, you know, a CD sound recording right there on the game, it sort of blew the gates open in terms of what could be possible for game music. Now, anything is possible. Literally any kind of audio recording can be your background music for the game. Do you remember when that technology became commonplace and games with that kind of music, with the advent of that kind of freedom, do you remember how you felt at that moment? Whether did you feel, finally, we are liberated? Or was there any sense? Was there any sense of, well, maybe we're actually losing something by gaining all this freedom?
It's probably both. I would argue that it wasn't the CD that did that. I would say that it didn't really come until a few years later, with the PlayStation 2 and right. The original Xbox, which was the DVD. I did a bunch of games. The first generation of PlayStation games. I remember. I did the first Madden. What was the Crystal Dynamics game? Blazing Dragons. And originally we were thinking, hey, this is awesome. We can do this awesome Redbook CD music, which is the full fidelity music. And that happened for some early PlayStation games. But what really happened really quickly is game developers were like, whoa, 600 megabytes on this CD. We can put all sorts of cool custom full motion video cinematics. Huh. And there became no room for music. The very first Madden that shipped for PlayStation and Saturn, they shipped at the same time. The only thing that is studio recorded music in that game is the, you know, 3-minute opening theme. All the rest of I had to do with the built-in sound chip.
Okay.
As synthesized music, because cinematics and dialogue. The first game I did that had 3,000 lines of dialogue was a PlayStation game, and that's essentially the entire disc is dialogue. And, oh yeah, there's some gameplay over here. But DVDs were different. DVD, that's when you finally like, okay, we've got, you know, 4 or 7 gigabytes. And, that was truly liberating, because then, yeah, I can go record 90 minutes of music, 120 minutes of music, and with compression technology, stick that in the game, and have that be the music. So it was hugely liberating. At that time, that was right when I kind of stopped doing composition prolifically. And that's when I was at Microsoft. And so I was more on the tech side for a little bit there. And so a lot of, but yeah, that's when, you know, scores like Halo and stuff came out. There's kind of no turning back. I do feel like we lost something, you know, even back in 89, I'm thinking I did a game called Black Knight 2000. And because, as I was mentioning, you've got these individual, you know, you're entering every note individually.
Right.
We had very fine micro control over the whole sound package. And we had technology in there that, we could do, obviously, you know, musical transitions on beat or half note or measure boundaries. I could time sound effects so that they, were quantized to, like, on Black Knight 2000, the pop bumper sounds are quantized to 16th notes and they sound like tom-toms. What else? Oh, there are some sound effects that what they do is they look at the underlying key of the music and will automatically transpose themselves to the proper key so they fit in with the background music at any time. We could selectively say, okay, I only have 8 channels for my music and sound effects. Let me, when this sound effect plays, I'll remove these specific instruments from the musical mix to use those for sound, which also lets us control the mix really well so things don't get sort of cacophonic.
Right.
There's a lot of that micro interactivity that we kind of lost when we went to the high production values of studio recorded music. And I certainly wouldn't go back, but it is having that tool not as accessible to composers, I think, has hurt things a little bit. And you can do some things, right? You know, Wise has done a good job with adding their MIDI stuff to their digital audio stuff. And certainly games like Peggle 2 have pushed the boundaries for, you know, modern day interactive music. But I do kind of miss that really low level control that we used to have on the whole sound package.
I only briefly was part of that era, you know, starting in the late 90s, early 2000s, where it was still viable to do music in a way where you had that individual, very granular access and ability to modify in real time. And despite that brief foray, I miss it as well. I really hope that actually with perhaps new power comes new paradigms that are worth exploring. it's something that I miss. I really, really miss it. And honestly, when you were describing some of the stuff that was going on in Black Knight 2000, which is, you know, this late 80s pinball game, I couldn't help but smile because I have very strong memories of playing Black Knight 2000, not necessarily at that time, but you know, when I was in college and looking at interesting things that were happening in game audio, there were people that were telling me about this game, and I went ahead and sought it out in various places, whether it be you know, pinball collectors in Southern California or the Pinball Hall of Fame in Las Vegas. And I remember thinking, damn, this is really good. It sounds so cool. So, like, seriously, that really had such an impact on me as I was studying to get into this world of game audio and music.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, that was a really, really fun game to work on. So Steve Ritchie, the game designer, was also a guitar player. So he would kind of come down to my office and he'd play some riffs on the guitar, and I'd kind of spin them into FM interactive soundtracks. Dan Fortin has a track on that game as well. And it's just a really good AV package. And it does something that I'm still waiting for modern day video games to do. You know, at the end of a ball, let's say, right, the ball drains. At that point in a pinball machine, there's what we call the bonus sequence, mm-hmm. right, where it's a little breather and the game tells you, okay, you got this many bonus points and a 1, 2, 3, 4x bonus multiplier, and before it goes and then kicks the ball onto the plunger for you to play the next ball. And the programmer for that game, who's Ed Boon, who went on to create Mortal Kombat after he did Black Knight 2000, we worked together and made it such that that whole visual bonus sequence doesn't begin until a half note boundary in the music. Mm-hmm. And the idea there is that we wanted the whole feel of the game, not just the music, but the visuals, to have this consistent flow and feel, because it's kind of a rocking beat once you put your quarter in. So we keep that going and we accentuate it with the visuals. So, and then when the bonus sequence is over and all of the 3x, 4x, 5x, 6x are all awaits from signals from the musical score that I put into the score to make those visual displays occur. And then even when that's over, we waited until a half note boundary, and the solenoid that kicks to fire the ball onto the plunger also waits for a half note boundary. So we have the game literally holding back and waiting for a musically opportune moment to do something like show the visuals or kick the ball onto the plunger, just to make the whole audiovisual package feel coherent. And that was, again, largely because the programmer was so bought in to the notion of having a really tight integration of sound, music, and gameplay, all driven by the beat of the music, which is pretty darn cool.
That's great. It's like if I was just I'm smiling so hard right here. I was thinking that, like, what the list of features that you mentioned just a moment ago, all the different kind of musical tricks and the way that you could use those limitations to your advantage, and mixing and things like that. and also this that you just mentioned just now, I was just thinking that if somebody just dropped into this conversation right now and didn't know that we were talking about technology from 30 years ago, they would be saying, oh, what kind of amazing audio technology is this? This is like cutting edge, bleeding edge stuff. But no, actually, it's 3 decades old. And in the meantime, we've kind of gone in a different direction, which has allowed us, I guess, much, much more artistic freedom in how we want to, you know, the ideas that we want to express and the aesthetics of music. So much more broad opportunity there with the way that we produce music for video games now. However, doing any of the things that you've just mentioned was done 30 years ago in Black Knight 2000. Doing any of them now with the current way that we work is just very, very technically challenging. And it's just hilarious that, you know, after 30 years, yes, we've come a long way, but we've gone in a certain direction that has made some of these really, like, just fundamentally useful, musically useful tricks that you can do to tie the music in with a video game have made them just very, very technically difficult. So what a funny, funny situation that we're in.
It was a little bit, it came kind of from the power of the sound operating system that was written originally for the Williams game. So Bill Parod and Chris Graner, Chris is the one who hired me into the industry back in 87, wrote this little system for this little microprocessor to drive the Yamaha synthesis chip. And as I had mentioned, they had both come from kind of the traditional academic computer music background. And they had a vision for what it could be. And then it was written well enough that it was easy enough for somebody like me or Dan Thornton to add on to it and add features. Now, when we wanted to add a feature like one thing we added was, remember I said we had these text files with the score in them, like note, comma, E3, comma, you know,
yeah,
60. We added in a command where literally we could, from the musical score, fire off one of the flash lamps on the playfield. So that way the flash, the lights could flash in time to the music. And if I changed the music, I could change when the flashes occurred. And it was much easier than trying to coordinate with a programmer. But in order to add that feature in, we had to literally write what's called assembly language. So it's a very low-level programming language that you need to do. Mm. Once we did it, now it was available as something we could just access with our text files. So it still is, it's possible to do those things through WISE and FMOD, through, you know, callback notifications and things like that, which does have me scratching my head sometimes why we don't see a little bit more of it. Especially something as simple as, you know, waiting for a game scene change, you know, for a major level scene change for a musical boundary to occur. Because the linear media people, right, the film scorers, spend an inordinate amount of time making sure that their music flows properly with scene changes. And so the idea of, yeah, let's have a little WISE event that fires off back to the game when that half note or measure boundary, that's not difficult to do. Somebody has to have buy-in that it gets done. And again, for the pinball games, I was lucky that I had somebody like Ed Boone, who really gets the importance of audio in games, as the programmer to help make it happen.
There's a paradox that now that any kind of music interactivity with the game, any kind of responsiveness is possible, you know, all the techniques we're describing, but there's so much more infrastructure and the teams are so much larger and the decision-making is so distributed that I think far less of those sensitivities are built into music or into the game than there might have been back when there weren't tools to do it, where you had to roll your own solutions between tightly integrated teams of a few people. So that's, I guess, the cost of tools.
Right. And to be fair, too, you know, I like to say pinball is the original casual game. And it could be that some of these aesthetic decisions about interactivity are more suited to casual games than they are towards long narratives or RPGs or something. So I definitely get what you're talking about. And I kind of maybe give the developers today a little bit more slack. The games are so much more complicated that literally Ed was the only programmer on that game. Ed was the only programmer on Mortal Kombat. you didn't need teams of programmers with massively complicated systems, you know, where they're just trying to get the thing going.
You eventually stopped, you know, working day to day as a sound designer and composer. But then you found yourself over at Microsoft working on what were going to be the audio capabilities of the Xbox. And that's, well, one, those were really cool. I remember when I saw what was possible, both from a hardware and software perspective and looking at the Xact tool, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. This is really neat. But besides that, I was wondering if at that time, if you had an image in mind of what it would be like to work on sound and music in the future while you were working with Microsoft in that capacity.
Yeah, thanks. I almost went cold turkey composition. I was getting kind of burned out. I find myself kind of writing the same song over and over again for different games. And so when Microsoft called, I was like, yeah, this could be a cool change. And that's, you mentioned Xact, and that's kind of what it was at the time, because there was no Wise, there was no FMod Studio or FMod Designer even. And we put this amazing sound chip into the original Xbox. It was kind of like Pro Tools on a chip.
That NVIDIA chip, the MCP.
NVIDIA MCPX, good memory. It was 256 voices, and 64 of them could be HRTF 3D, and it built in Dolby. The first time, you know, we take surround sound in games for granted now, but there was no real-time surround sound in games, in console games back then. So there was lots of really, really cool stuff. But we were finding is that, and, you know, we modified all the programming interfaces so that a programmer could access all of these components. These really, you know, the LFOs and the ADSR envelopes and, you know, surround panning, all this cool stuff. And we discovered that games were just really underutilizing the sound chip. And it was because the people who understood what the chip did were the composers and sound designers, not the programmers. But the programmers were the ones who had the capabilities to actually use the thing. And so that's where Xact came from. It was a desire to try to create a tool that would put the stuff the sound designers and composers knew about in front of them in a graphical interface and let them set the LFO, let them set the filters, let them, you know, specify interactive music layers. So they didn't have to try to just explain to the programmer what they wanted and hope the programmer had time to code it up. So that's kind of where Xact came from, which again, it's kind of the paradigm that we're using today, right? Tools like Wise and FMod are very much, you know, Xact-like. And to be fair, right, I didn't invent that paradigm. There were some early console tools like something called Musix by Factor 5, which was, it was a different vibe because it was Nintendo-based. But the idea of having sort of a separate tool for the composer and sound designer that creates these blobs of data that the programmer doesn't have to spend a lot of time or effort thinking about. It just says, hey, play this sound now. And unbeknownst to the programmer, that's playing these five different wave files that are picked from randomly and put through these different DSP processes. So, yeah, the idea about that separation is kind of where that came from. And that was the business justification I could make to Microsoft as to why, yeah, I need a team of four people to go spin this up so that we can use, because we were super proud of our sound chip compared to the PlayStation 2s.
Yeah, I mean, it was really cool. And yeah, you do talk about just in general sound being underutilized, but there were some really great moments in my game playing memories of playing that Xbox One, not the current Xbox One. Xbox One. And hooking it up and playing actual Dolby Digital quality sound with a really basic home theater in a box, but it was really actually effectively using those rear speakers and the center channel for interesting establishing of the world character or connecting with the mechanics and game. Why am I blanking on the name?
Because you've been up for 9 hours.
That would be it.
There's that. It's based on the movie. Oh, right. Yeah, Chronicles of Riddick. Man, that was a game that really used sound very well for the storytelling. And it was such good stuff happening there. And you couldn't do that type of stuff on the other consoles at the time, you know, that you didn't really have that hardware or software capability that was provided in the dev packages that came from Nintendo or Sony back in the day. But
yeah, well, rumor has it, you know, Marty has said, whether it's true or not, that Marty O'Donnell, the audio director for Halo and composer for Halo, he said, yeah, the fact that Xbox had surround sound was the reason that he decided to come with Bungie when Microsoft bought them back in, what was it, 2000. Mm. So that's a whole nother story, that just the idea of getting Microsoft and Dolby to try and do a business deal together was, that took like a solid year.
That's cool. Was, I mean,
that's good for a game sound con story over beers or something.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, there's so many stories that happen during Game Sound Con. And I, for one, am really looking forward to going back to Game Sound Con just under 2 months from now.
It's so, a month and a day. Holy crap.
Oh, geez. Really?
Yeah, believe me.
Get with the program, Vince. You almost missed it by a month.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, October 25th, which is frighteningly close for me right now.
End of October. Okay, so you, of course, are the creator of Game Sound Con. And for the last few years, it's been an online event, but you're back to in-person. And what are you looking forward to with Game Sound Con this year?
Oh, let's see. Well, I always look forward to it being over. Because
you're the only person allowed to say that, I think.
Because then my stress level goes way down. I'm looking forward to being back in person. I mean, it's been really wonderful going online. It was a much better experience than I thought it was going to be online. I don't know if you did any of the VR hangouts that we had, but
they were good.
It was really surprising. In VR, it had that conference feel vibe, even down to the awkwardness when, like, you see a group of four or five people talking and you kind of want to get in the conversation but don't quite know how to join the group. It had that exact same utter awkwardness feel to it. But yeah, there's really no substitute for kind of being in person. So yeah, I'm looking forward to being in person. I'm looking forward to seeing what streaming is like, which is again, we're going fully hybrid, so every session is going to be live streamed for remote people, which is a whole nother set of gray hairs for me. Again, in terms of things that can go wrong, it's just like another factor of five things that can potentially go wrong. Again, learning a lot just from being online in terms of organization. And one thing that I started doing online was having a single studio or company doing multiple talks on a similar topic. Like the first year online, we had Riot do, I think, 4 talks just on their whole approach to audio. So it was like, you know, 4 hours of talks from one studio. And this year we've got, 2 hours of talks just on Ratchet & Clank sound design. Because that's such a great sounding game. Sony is doing later in the day kind of a featured sound design talk on interactive mixing that I'm really excited about. Just getting back together and, you know, having drinks at the mixer event and seeing everybody again and kind of hoping that there's some kind of semblance of pre-COVID life or post-COVID life for things like this.
Brian, how many years has has GSC been going at this point?
13, I think, now. 2009 was our first one.
And jumping back to the genesis of the conference, what inspired you to organize this? What gave you the sense that there was a need for this kind of educational conference, networking conference, particularly targeted towards game audio people?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. When I left Microsoft, I kind of had like a four-pillar thing of things I was going to do. I was going to do more composition again, some consulting. I wanted to start GameSoundCon, and there's a fourth pillar. I don't remember what it was. But what when I was at Microsoft on the Xbox team, one of the things I spent a lot of time doing was flying around and like teaching people how to design sounds for the Xbox, partly using XACT and things like that. And what I realized is that, you know, back to what I think Alex was talking about, right? When the DVD hit, and now we could make music in a studio, we go to Abbey Road and record the orchestra if we wanted to, all of a sudden the floodgates opened for game composers, especially, but also sound designers. And what I learned when I was trying to teach people how to do sound for the Xbox is that I just had to teach them the fundamentals of what is game audio. How is nonlinear audio different than linear audio that they were all used to? And so I started GameSoundCon to basically try to help these people who are coming in from traditional media, television, movies, and things like that, and not have them all trip over the same things I was seeing them trip over as I was seeing them start to work on games, on Xbox games. So that was originally specifically targeted for people not in the industry, but that wanted to learn more about it.
Now, when you think of GSC today, there's multiple tracks and a number of lecturers, and there's tech demos. What did the very first GSC look like?
The very first GameSoundCon, it was in LA. It was one room. It was 2 days. I take that back. We did have a second room for something I'll talk about in a second. So it was 2 days, but they're like, you know, five talks one day and five talks the next day. And I think I did half the talks. So I think there were 45 attendees or something. You know, and one of the panels was great. One of the panels had Nile Rodgers, wow. Marty O'Donnell.
Wow.
I mean, it was like, whoa. So yeah, these 40 people got a really good, really good experience. The second room we had actually was Harmonix at the time did something called the Rock Band Network. This was back when Rock Band, the video game, which is like Guitar Hero, they had envisioned bands being able to make content for Rock Band themselves. And so they had a series of tutorials for how do I take my own music, put it in a format that Rock Band can make it a Guitar Hero-like playable game, and then ship that. You know, unfortunately, that kind of fizzled out after about a year. But so that was the original GameSoundCon, was, you know, 40 people, you know, 10 sessions over 2 days. And then gradually more and more content got added for established game audio people. And now most of the content is for established game. I still have some of the intro talks. I do an intro to game audio talk. Tom Salta is doing some sort of essentials of interactive composition. But the rest of the conference is, you know, more what's the state of the art, what's Ratchet and Clank doing, what's, you know, Deathloop doing, you know, we have a session on voice, you know, doing the voices for the Guardians of the Galaxy's creatures and things like that. So yeah, it's grown to this year, we're six rooms. I think it's 74, 76 talks. With 120 speakers or something like that. So it's been kind of fun to see it grow. You know, again, COVID kind of took a sledgehammer to everything in 2020.
Understandably, but, yeah.
You know, coming back now, we'll kind of see what it's like. But also this year, we're excited because Epic is joining us as a sponsor. And the Epic Unreal Engine 5 has some really, really interesting audio tech in it. And they're doing 2 days of sessions just on Unreal 5 audio with Meta Sounds. And the Fortnite team is going to talk about what they're doing with Unreal 5 audio. So yeah, we've got the main sessions and then Wise Unreal doing their stuff in their own room. And we have Audio Kinetic doing Wise sessions in their own room. So it should be pretty fun.
It feels like in some ways the scope and depth of GSC has started to parallel the audio track from GDC. And other than the convenience for LA composers, how would you differentiate those two things? You know, what does GSC have that maybe just taking all the audio track courses and seminars at GDC might not offer?
Yeah, there are a couple things, and I should put a disclaimer in. I'm also on the board of GDC, so on the audio board there. So a couple things. So at the 1,000-foot level, you know, GDC, you know, from a networking perspective, it's a great networking out event, right? If you're, you know, most of the composers that I know who go are busy with meetings with game developers or, you know, game companies or publishers or things like that. So it's not as much among the game audio community networking as it is kind of outwards. Or Game Sound Con, because it's only audio people, it's sort of the conference to network within the industry. As far as the sessions themselves, being audio focused only allows us to go deeper into some subjects. I mentioned sort of the deep dives that we do or having multiple, right? GDC really couldn't have Riot give 5 talks, as an example. So I do think it lets us go a little bit deeper and also have a little bit of the sort of, I call them sort of crazy scientist talks, right? And these are talks by, you know, a lot of times they come from academia on technologies that, you know, aren't necessarily practical right now in games, but, you know, a couple of years down the road may very well be. And, you know, example of that, you know, 10 years ago, HRTF would not have been something that you would think about doing very much in real time on game systems. And of course, nowadays, you know, PlayStation 5 has this insanely powerful HRTF engine built into it. So that sorts of things. So it's that sort of different levels of stuff. We have 10 sessions, or I guess 8, that are just dedicated to dialogue. You know, the dialogue pipeline, how to work with voice actors, things like that. So yeah, it's mostly a matter of depth, I think.
And if you think of the future, I know it's kind of a transitional moment now because you're returning back to what feels like normal after some time of doing online only. But are there ambitions you have for the future of the conference? Are there directions you'd like to see it go or kinds of presentations you'd love to bring in that aren't currently there?
Oh, what a good question. Yeah, I probably should be thinking about that. Huh? the easy short answer is I get pretty regular requests to do one like over in London or Cologne or something like that. So that's, you know, just sort of expanding in that sense. I really have been pleased with the way the deeper talks have worked. Again, it was, you know, I mean, it was Riot 2 years ago. Shoot, what studio? It was Hi-Rez last year. You know, just being able to have this whole, a holistic view of what goes into a AAA space. So probably more things kind of like that. I guess just sort of growing in scope. But the actual content, I think I have a lot of the bases covered, right? We've got business tracks, we've talks, career talks, music creative talks, music technical talks, maybe a little more on technical sound design, although, you know, the Wise and Unreal sessions kind of cover that base pretty nicely.
At the beginning.
Okay, you shamed me into realizing I need to renew my my 5-year plan. I had written one, you know, back in the day when I first started the thing. I wrote like a, you know, a nice little roadmap of where it should be. And yeah, it's time to refresh that. Thanks for the kick in the butt on that.
You heard it, listeners. This is where it happened. If something really cool happens at GSC next year, this is the inception of that idea. You know, at the very beginning, you mentioned how you feel relief after the conference is done. And I think anyone who's ever produced anything understands that emotion. And it occurs to me that if you start branching out, you start doing them in Cologne and in other parts of the world, you may never feel that emotion again. You may always be jumping from one conference to the next.
Yeah, when I first started Game Sound Con, I actually did it multiple times a year in multiple locations. I did The first year it was LA, then a month and a half later I was in San Francisco. Then the next year I did it in San Francisco, Seattle, and New York. But again, that was back when I was giving half the talks. And so it was fairly straightforward for me to like take what I did in Seattle and replicate it largely in New York and not a big deal. But when it's, when it's four speakers and I do a lot of the talks, that's easy. When it's 100 speakers and 70 talks, that's not quite so easy.
There's an analogy to be drawn to what we were talking about earlier. When you have a small team developing a game, it's very easy to make a lot of, you know, integration of music and gameplay. And as the infrastructure gets bigger, to do anything takes more work. So you can kind of see a similar situation here.
Yeah, and that's a really great analysis. Yeah, it's very analogous to that. That's kind of how I feel that GameSoundCon is now, a piece of game code that's been around for a dozen years, and I can add new features to it, but I'm also, want to make sure I don't introduce any new bugs.
There's like a part of me that just wants to wrap the circle around because of that whole idea of modern game production, especially things like live games where you don't experience the feeling of ending something and that utter satisfaction there because you have to go on to the next build that's happening 2 months from now. We're not going to do that here.
Oh.
We're going to actually end this episode and we're going to do it in the typical fashion, which means conspicuous consumption. This is the part of the show where we share what it is that we've been playing or watching or listening to lately. And Brian, since you are the guest today, why don't you start us off? Have you been actually checking out anything new or fresh or even just new to you?
My kids have me playing Destiny 2 with them. My son's actually a tester at Bungie. And so he is... he proudly shows me off stuff that he's worked on. And in doing so, because it's the three of us, so that's a natural number, to do some of the campaigns and whatnot. And I'm sure I'm not nearly as good as I think I am because he's just ridiculously good at it. And I'm sure he's like healing me and, protecting me from all sorts of things that would normally just slay me down. So I've been super, really enjoying that a lot. And I always kind of get back to pinball. That to me is my go-to game. There's a lot of pinball's had a really good rebirth. And so when I want to kind of relax and chill out with a game, I'll bop out to the arcade and play or go down to my basement or something.
That's really cool. You actually just reminded me of one question which I wanted to ask, which is, what pinball machines do you have at hand?
I have Star Wars, a Apollo 13, a Tommy, a Jurassic Park, a Banzai Run, a Space Station, and a Back to the Future. So those seven.
Definitely movie theme.
And unlike my...
That's Fox, awesome.
I have all the Genesis games I did, which is, about Genesis and Super Nintendo. They all fit in a nice little box. Keeping your old pinball machines is a little bit more space intensive than cartridge games.
Don't mind me over here. I'm just booking a flight to Seattle right now.
Yeah.
We finally figured
gonna
out.
Make a
Let's do it.
Yeah, beeline from the airport straight to Brian's basement.
I do not have a Black Knight 2000, though. And I also do not have Swords of Fury, which is my... I wish I did, because I really like the music on that game.
Well, that's cool. While I'm trying to figure out about flights up there, Mike, what have you been checking out lately?
You know what I've been playing as part of a kind of a visit to the past on my iPhone? Cannibalt, which is this, it's probably like 10 years old, but it's an endless runner in a kind of dystopian sci-fi environment. And I was amazed that the game could run because I think when you start it up, it says like, this may not be compatible with the operating system. Go tell the developers to update it. And I thought, that's not an email they're really looking forward to getting from me. But the game is insanely addictive and very, very replayable. It's kind of a perfect casual time waster. And it has a really infectiously catchy kind of electronic score. I don't remember. Is it Danny? Somebody Danny. I'm confident of his first name. I should look this up. Danny.
Oh, Danny B. Yeah, Danny Baranowski.
Yes. Which is just a great soundtrack. It's actually, it's something you can, it's fun enough to listen to outside of the game. But the game is really addictive. And if it still runs on your mobile device, it's well worth the $3 or whatever it takes to get it.
That is super cool. That Cannibalt was 13 years ago now.
Wow.
That's so weird to think about. But wow. 13 years ago. Okay, I don't want to think about that anymore. Instead, Alex, what have you been playing lately?
Well, actually, I haven't been playing, I haven't had much time to play anything recently, but I have been listening to, it's one of the luxuries of running a company is that sometimes, you know, you get to listen to other people's music that's not your own, which is great. And recently, while I've been working, I've discovered this amazing Dutch electronica artist called Roel Funken, R-O-E-L-F-U-N-C-K-E-N, Funken, I suppose it would be. And I might be late to the party because apparently he's quite well known in electronica circles, but just absolutely mind-blowing. Like the every album is very different. He's very prolific in the amount of music that he outputs. You can go check him out on SoundCloud. But I'm a bit of a purist when it comes to electronic music, as you know. And Roel Funken has this amazing ability to sort of dance around between electronica genres. A little bit of, you know, Detroit techno, a little bit of electro, a little bit of drum and bass, a little bit of ambient, a little bit of industrial. He dances between them, but in a way that is extremely satisfying to a purist like me. Not just sort of randomly mashing parts from different genres together. So yes, if you are interested in a very stimulating adventure into electronic music, I highly recommend Roel Funken. So there you go.
I think at this point we can simulate an Alex music recommendation with two random numbers. One picks a style of music from the 20th century or later, and the other picks a country in Northern Europe. And you just combine these two. And you get an Alex music recommendation.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. I guess you don't need me on the show really anymore. After it could just be an algorithm now.
It's nice to know that we have a backup in case something happens to you.
That's right. How about you, Vince?
So I have fired up the Xbox, and I decided to get some new games there, courtesy of Game Pass. I started up Deathloop, but honestly, I haven't been playing it because I also realized that Ni No Kuni, which was the old PlayStation 3 role-playing game, is now out in remastered format for Xbox and on Game Pass. And that's actually been really fun to check out. It's remastered, but quite honestly, the original Ni No Kuni was a very beautiful and beautiful sounding game at that time even. So it was actually really fun and comforting to check this game out again. It's even though it's a video game, it is actually a Ghibli-related sort of development. So Ghibli people actually worked on this game, and it has a soundtrack by Joe Hisaishi, famous for his soundtracks for things like Spirited Away and Princess Mononoke and all that. So it's definitely a good playing experience as well as a good listening experience there. So that's my game right awesome. Now.
I saw him conduct a Studio Ghibli concert here in Seattle a couple of months ago. And I know it's a long tour for him, but he just looked like he was having so much fun.
It really does. He's been at it for literally decades.
Yeah.
But he shows no signs of stopping, and we're better off for it. His work is awesome. Yeah. Okay, so with that, this was episode 230 of the Game Audio Hour, and thank you so much to Brian for joining us for this episode.
Oh, thank you all so much for having me. This was incredibly fun.
No, thank you, thank you. To all of you out there, if you liked what you heard, feel free to support us by subscribing to us at your podcast purveyor of choice and leaving us a review to keep us in the forefront of the algorithm. You can also follow us on Twitter at Game Audio Hour, where we also post notices about future episodes, as well as try to support some other fun and positive voices out there in the Twitterverse. And of course, the easy way to do all of this without having to remember any of what I just said is to go to GameAudioHour.com. So go ahead and do that while we go and submit our new change lists. Bye.
Go and submit what? New change list?
Yes. I decided I would just use like some Perforce parlance.
Okay.
I mean, I suppose I should have, while we go in and push our latest stuff to Git or something.
But okay, now you're making sense.
I was like, did I want to go Git or did I want to go Perforce? I was like, I'll go Perforce and see what happens.